Welcome back, everybody. Clearwater Jazz Holidays, Young Lions Jazz Master Virtual Sessions. I don't know how many of these we've done by now, but I am so happy to have Jeremy Carter and James Suggs with us. If you are tuning in expecting to see Sam Dillon, Sam unfortunately couldn't be with us, but we are so happy to have James with us. Haven't done one in a while with James, and Jeremy Carter is going to lead us through. But what I'm thinking is this is kind of dangerous, having the most sought-after saxophonist and the most sought-after trumpet player in the same virtual session today. A little bit dangerous, but I'm willing to do it. How you guys doing?
Great, great. We may shut down the internet.
I want to thank...
I'm just glad to hang out with Jeremy. It's fun.
Well... we just had both of these amazing performers with us as part of our Wonderlust music series not too long ago at one of the rooftop concerts, which was such a good time. Music was so great, and they even sat in with each other on a couple tunes, which was just a treat for everybody who was there. So thank you for being there, both of you. And what can I say? These sessions have been wonderful. We're starting to really engage a lot of the band directors and their students who are regularly going to our online resource, the studio, and checking these things out after these live sessions. And those are brought to us by our great sponsors, Blue Water Wealth Management at Steward Partners and Duke Energy. And we always like to give a shout out to our great friends and supporters at the Al Downing Tampa Bay Jazz Association for believing in the Young Lions program. Jeremy and James are regular participants of Clearwater Jazz Holiday Education and Outreach. Both have their own really amazing professional careers, the solo artists in their own right, Jeremy Carter Rubber Band, and James Suggs, who, if you haven't checked out his work online, go stream it now, or buy it. It's just fantastic. And James is also a regular participant in many different ensembles throughout the Tampa Bay area and beyond. Both also have performed on the big stage at Clearwater Jazz Holiday. And we're just really lucky to have them both in our community, helping to inspire the next generation of players and just adding to a really vibrant cultural scene we have in Tampa Bay. So thank you both so much for being part of this and being part of our extended family here for all you do. I'm going to turn it over to you both and let's see what happens.
All right.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jeremy.
Yeah. Welcome everybody to the Clearwater Jazz Holiday virtual sessions. Our Young Lions. We'll get the Young Lions. We'll get the Old Lions. We'll rejuvenate and refurbish the Old Lions. And we'll get everybody excited about playing music. We are sad we couldn't have Sam Dillon with us today, but let me just reference one of my mentors, Buster Cooper. Before he passed, Buster and I became really great friends, and I remember talking with him, and I asked Buster, I was asking him a question about Kenny Garrett, and you know, he's kind of an old timer. He was part of the old guard of the music, and I wasn't sure whether Buster would know about Kenny Garrett, and he just said, Jeremy, I know everybody. And so, to quote Buster Cooper, I know everybody. So while Sam couldn't be with us today, I was fortunate enough to have James Suggs come in and be a part of this section. So many thanks to you for taking the time. Yeah, man, to be a part of it. We have shared many a stage together. And taking many trips up and down the road. And I think it would be really cool to have, your insight as part of the archives for Clearwater Jazz Holiday. And just, you know, like I said, we'll talk about a few different topics. And, hopefully if somebody, jumps in, we can answer some questions and just kind of go from there. But just for the people who don't know who you are, and who aren't familiar with your music. Where'd you get started with the music? And, you know, who were your early mentors? Like, what really, you know, sparked your interest and got you motivated to take music further?
I started when I was 9 years old, and that was in Pennsylvania. We moved around a lot because my dad worked in higher education, and he was always looking for a better job. So almost immediately when I was 10, my parents took me to a Wynton Marsalis concert, and they forced me backstage to meet him. He gave me his trumpet and said, play something. I was so nervous. I only could play a C major scale, but he then gave me a 15-minute lesson, just, you know, showing me how to breathe, how to, you know, make a nice sound. He sat down on the piano. He said, you need to learn piano. So that was my first influence. And then after that, it was, you know, Louis Armstrong and Miles Davis and Kenny Dorham, Blue Mitchell. But yeah, it was, you know, I always say, you know, like I started young, but I didn't practice young. I just played young. You know, I had the trumpet and I was just figuring out sounds and, you know, having fun. I didn't really get into practicing until I was probably in college.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I kind of, you know, was the same way. I started when I was about the same, like 9, but I didn't start practicing until maybe sophomore or junior year of high school, you know. But once I did, I you know, I started to dig in, like really explore the, you know, the history of some of the legends, you know, just learning about the music.
I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing either. Like, I think it's nice to just like have an instrument and just try to figure it out and play it. Not necessarily going, you know, I have to spend 8 hours in the practice room at 10 years old. Like, it's just nice to just treat it like a toy, treat it like something that you're having fun with, and then start getting more serious. I think that's kind of a natural evolution of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I did the session yesterday that was called musical storytelling. And it, I mean, that was a big part of it. Just, you know, just playing for the sake of play.
Yeah.
Not so much like the theory and like the scales and the structure and all that stuff. You obviously need to have a grasp of all that stuff, but and when you're actually applying some of these tools, you know, just have fun and play.
Exactly. You know?
Yeah. So who are some of the guys that, you know, that really, really got you going in terms of trumpet specifically?
Yeah, I think, you know, Wynton was probably the top guy that really got me going. And then, you know, I had a great teacher, Max Colley Jr. in Michigan, that kind of just threw all of his favorites at me, and they ended up being my favorites too. And those are the people that I still go back to. Like I said, Louis Armstrong, Miles Davis. And also there, you know, like specific Miles Davis, you know, I was kind of scared to listen to Miles after the 60s.
Right.
But before that, I was, you know, I was all about it, you know.
Yeah. Well, the reason that I start the session this way, it's because most of the people that I talk to, accomplished musicians, they usually credit their early educators for their success, you know what I mean? So that it's just a point to highlight how important it is what Clearwater Jazz Holiday does in terms of their education and their outreach in the schools, and just having different programs and different access points for kids that may not have the same opportunity or may not have the interest from or may not have been exposed to it. So yeah, just a huge kudos to Clearwater Jazz Holiday and everything that they're doing with the education side of it. So when you're preparing to get on the topic a little bit, when you're preparing for, let's say, how does your preparation, I guess I should say, vary if you're getting ready for a big band concert, or I know you have Louis Armstrong coming up pretty soon. How does your preparation method sort of shift depending on the gig?
This is number one for me.
There we go. Let's talk about it.
I'm obsessed with lists. And, yes, you know, I could do it on my phone, but I'm too old school to do it on my phone or on my computer. So I just, you know, old pencil and paper, write it out, you know. For me, you know, that's number one for anything. It doesn't matter if it's big band. Doesn't matter if it's my own project. Doesn't matter if it's I'm a side man with a singer, for instance. I have to learn these tunes. I need to mentally and actually physically write a list out so I can just kind of get it all figured out. How am I going to attack this? You know, it might not be much. It might be just like three things, but for some reason I need to put a list down, you know.
Right. Are you the same way? Yes. It depends. I do have, like, I don't always put pen to paper, but I do more often now because I just, my memory, I'll forget things. I had a pastor tell me when I was really young, he's like, a sharp pencil beats a long memory any day. You know what I mean?
That's true.
So, regardless of what it is, I'll have things that I feel are necessary to achieve to have a sense of I feel like I'm prepared for this performance, mm-hmm. You know. Right, like you said, it may be only like two or three things. Maybe it's a song I'm not particularly all that comfortable with. Maybe it's just, right, if you're a leader, like, what am I going to say? What's the song list going to be like? You know, what's the vibe going to be like?
Exactly. And, you know, it's almost like, it's almost too much to just think of on the spot or maybe the day before. It's too much. And I get stressed out. I get freaked out. Which I think is natural, you know, like I just want to make it easier for me. So I started making lists, you know, what songs, first of all, I started off with songs. If I'm running, for instance, you mentioned I'm doing a Louis Armstrong tribute on October 2nd at the Palladium. And so I had a list of 30 songs that I wrote out. And then it was just a matter of just like, you know, getting them down to about, you know, 15, and then I can choose from that list. That's easier for me, for my mind to think about.
Right.
And then it's a matter of tracking down the lead sheets, if the guys need the lead sheets, if I need the lead sheets, getting those to them, making sure everyone is on the same page as far as the keys, what time we need to get there, rehearsal, if there is one, sound check, and all of that, you know?
Right. Yeah, this is really important for young musicians to think about, because often it's that oftentimes they just think about their responsibility to their instrument.
Yeah,
you know, and it doesn't really go any further than that. But just like you were saying, you listed this laundry list of things to do. None of them had anything to do with the trumpet yet.
Yeah, that's true.
You know what I'm saying? You haven't even touched the instrument yet.
Yeah,
you know.
Yep. Yeah, and it's like, you know, they say, you know, there are many great musicians that aren't great managers, or, you know, there's two sides that we kind of have to do. And, you know, I've been playing the trumpet since I was 9, but I haven't been, you know, scheduling gigs since I was 9. So
yeah,
that's something that I have to focus on more. You know, I have to be more attentive and just, you know, put more energy into that, I think.
Right. No, it's really important. Unless you have like a manager or somebody working on your behalf doing that. But as an independent contractor, as a sole proprietor or musician, you have to wear a lot of different hats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially if you're doing a lot of different things. Like if you only play in like one band and your responsibility is that, then you might not be under the same type of pressures. But as a horn player, right, talk a little bit about like just the different situations, like versus like you going in to be a sideman versus a leader or versus big band. Like when you actually get the trumpet in your hands, how does your preparation vary in that respect?
So as a leader, you're a leader. I mean, that's obvious, but I need to be on top of everything, you know, without a doubt, if I'm leading a band. And like I said, you know, the preparation with, you know, the band, the people in the band, but also the songs. I want to be confident that I'm going to play as a leader. I can step up and take, you know, if it's a train wreck, musically, then that's on me, right? That's on me. But and that's the funny thing about being a sideman. It's like you could just be like, oh, if there's a train wreck and you're a sideman, it's not your fault technically.
Right.
No, yeah. You don't take the blame, even though it may be your fault, but you don't take the blame. So I think there's a lot more pressure being a leader, but I think it's more valuable and beneficial going through that whole process. And what you mentioned something also, you know, getting to the horn is obvious. Like that's something we need to have daily upkeep and be always prepared, whether we're a sideman or we're a leader. Whether we're playing in a funk band, a big band, solo, whatever, we have to make sure that our horn, our instruments are up to the level that we want to be, you know, seen. But you mentioned something about talking. You know, when you're a leader, that's something that I think a lot of people don't think about. And someone actually, I was playing a gig last night, and someone said, you know, you're doing these tributes. Do you talk about the person you're doing a tribute to? And I said, of course. And they said, well, some people don't talk about the person. I said, that's part of my preparation.
Yeah.
Maybe I have to Google something. Maybe I have to go back to that CD that I haven't listened to in a while and check the liner notes, you know, like take notes. And this song is from this year and it's because of this. Like, I think that's a really important part of preparing.
Mm-hmm.
Preparation.
Yeah, absolutely. I was saying that you know, like before, like now the movies and television, they have soundtracks that are, you know, it's all digital, right?
Yeah.
But if you think about like black and white movies and silent films, the music was like the music was the soundtrack, it was the dialogue, it was everything.
Yeah.
Right? You had to actually like capture an emotion with the music. And I think that's kind of what's lost today. Like, right, people don't care about this. Some people will just do a tribute and not tell the story.
Yeah. Or even if it's not a tribute, you know, I'm sure that you can rattle off a few names of concerts you've been to, heroes of yours. And part of it that you remember to this day is what they said or how they spoke to the audience, their stage presence. And I'm sure on the contrary, you could also name some people that you were surprised that they just didn't talk to, you know, the audience. And it was like really cold. They played great, maybe, but, you know, there wasn't that interaction with the audience.
Yeah. Yeah. One concert comes to mind. I saw James Taylor James Taylor with Larry Goldings, mm-hmm. just the two of them. And Larry had this big organ that was like tapped into, they like had the show was like piped in, like they had it programmed, right? But the most important parts of the show that I remember that really captured me were when James Taylor was just sitting there telling stories and stuff.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah. I saw B.B. King a few years before he passed. And at that time, you know, he needed help on and off the stage. You know, his fingers weren't moving like they used to. But he was he was a grandfather, you know, like he was telling grandfather stories and everyone was just eating it up. It was beautiful. You know, like that is a part of it. You know, like we want to know who is on stage, not just by their instrument, but, you know, by them as a person as well.
Right. I think that's something that's kind of been lost I think it's a generational thing. Like nowadays, just the way that the delivery system or the vehicle, the way that people get their information now, like it's on the phone, it's a digital download, it's quick. You know, we used to go to the record store, like buy a record and listen to the whole record, right?
Exactly.
Read the liner notes. And then you got a better sense of who these musicians were as people. And you can get a better sense of like kind of where they were coming from on the bandstand. Thelonious Monk comes to mind, you know, just his Miles Davis.
Yep,
you know.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, I honestly do miss that that way of listening, listening to an album as it was supposed to be listened, you know, not just, you know, fast forwarding or skipping a track or, you know, pausing or turning it, you know, like actually listening from top to bottom. I mean, there's a reason why they took a lot of time in the studio and, you know, post production to figure that out.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, in terms of like different, what are you checking out now? Who are you listening to?
Man, and every time someone asks me that, I always feel lame because I'm still listening to like old stuff. Like, about a month ago or so, I had a gig in Columbus, Ohio, and I had some time off, and I just went for a walk, and I found this records, you know, this record shop, CD, whatever. And I went in there, and I came out with a stack of CDs, and my car still has a CD player, which is uncommon nowadays, but so that's where I listen to a lot of stuff, you know, and I bought a lot of like Errol Garner.
Wow.
Yeah. And I mean, he's just blowing my mind lately. Like, I don't know. I bought two Errol Garner CDs, and it's just so beautiful, man. And I can hear, it's really cool now going back to the older stuff, because now I can hear his influence on other people or people's influences on him, you know.
Right.
So it's cool just seeing how the whole thing works and how he became this icon that, you know, has been influential and was influenced. It's really cool. That's I don't know. I could name a few other names, but that's like the guy I'm listening to a lot, you know. Errol Garner is an amazing piano player, by the way.
Yeah, so, yeah. Gene Harris, Oscar Peterson.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
That happy jazz.
Happy jazz, exactly, man. I'm all about happy jazz. Phineas Newborn Jr.
Yeah.
Yeah. Happy jazz, man. Like, I was just talking about that with someone the other day. Like, Oscar Peterson is happy. Even if he's trying to play something sad, it sounds happy.
Right.
I think Chick Corea and Herbie Hancock also are like that. There's just people that they can't get away from playing happy, and I love it. It's beautiful.
Yeah, and all these guys have a way, like they all have a voice. Even like we're talking about piano players, it's the same instrument, but as soon as you hear them,
yeah,
instantaneously, you just know their fingers have a certain percussive nature to it, just the way they strike the key. You can tell, oh, that's Chick.
Exactly. And, you know, you got to think that some of these recordings, it's not their own favorite personal piano most of the time. You know, right. They might be this, like, out of tune, you know, bar piano or whatever. They're just sitting, hey, I'm here. Okay, let me try it out. Okay, press record. But they still sound like themselves. And I think that's just, it's beautiful. It's amazing.
Right. So what would you say to an aspiring musician to kind of help them to get a little bit more connected with their ensemble? You know, I know it's something you deal with all the time over there at USF, just trying to get the individuals to play as an ensemble, mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. I mean, it's a challenge, I think, for every ensemble. I try to make people, for instance, I run the second big band here. And out front, when I'm running it, I can hear which instruments are playing the same part together. But maybe if you're in the thick of it, you don't realize it. So I try to get them to realize, okay, you know, bass bone and Barry sax, you're playing the same part. That means you have to play together, you know. Or focus on this time, let's do it again, and focus on which section has the melody. A lot of times, you know, like if it's a song that no one really knows, a chart that no one knows the song, I'll ask, you know, who has the melody at this section? And sometimes no one knows. I think that's
what's that?
Yeah, because sometimes these charts are like complex and there's all like moving parts and right. And I'm in the back, you know, well in the front and listening, and I can't hear the melody, so I want to make them realize, okay, this is your function at this specific moment in this song, you're the melody, you should be standing out. Or listen to the rhythm section. There's a lot, I think that's a lot, a big thing that, especially as horn players, that we kind of forget about. We get caught up in playing our horns, whether it's in a small group or in a big band, that we don't focus on the rhythm section. And I think that's one of the most important things. I know you're a big rhythm section guy.
Love him. I love, man, the drummer, like, so just don't start soloing. No bass solos, no drum solos. We'll keep we'll edit that out. Because I'll have every drummer and every bass player mad at me.
You got to watch what you say, man.
I know. I'll be coming, hey, game, man, can you work? No. I don't want to work with you anymore. But
No. But it's true. Like, before you keep going, the head of the jazz program undergrad, Youngstown State University, where I went, he was this, you know, Tony Leonardi, this old Italian bass player, tough as nails, and he'd tell you just how it is. And, you know, he would have these bass players, his students, that would try to, you know, be fancy and do all this stuff. And he said, do your job. Do your job. Lay it down. You're a bass player, first and foremost. If you lay it down and then you can add a little more, that's fine. But first and foremost, do your job. I think that's really cool.
Yeah. I mean, when I'm teaching, doing private instruction, I always, you know, because most of the time it's horn players, I always try to convey to them that, like, we don't play all the time, right? So the rhythm section, they already kind of have a vibe. They got a groove going on, right? Maybe somebody else took a solo, the piano player or another horn player. So when you get in, you have to, like, mesh. You have to find your, like, they're not there supporting you. You know, you're part of the ensemble.
It's you like wanna... jump rope. It's like jump rope.
Double dutch, yeah.
Double dutch.
Yeah, exactly. Right? So when you get in, like, they're not like working for you and back there so you can get, like, so you want to try to, you know, I always talk about, like, the weight of expectation, right? So, like, do something that will provoke them to respond, right? Now you started a dialogue, you know? And then so back to, like, ensemble playing, like, if you're, how much do you talk about phrasing and dynamics? You know, because
I think that's, like, most of what I talk about. If it's individual, like, they messed up notes or they're, you know, missing, you know, harmonics or whatever, that's fine. I mean, that's not fine, but that's something that they can do on their own. They can, that's personal practice or sectional or whatever, they can work on. We don't have time to do that, you know, in a rehearsal,
right?
But yeah, so, but what we can talk about, what we do for a lot of the time, is we talk about dynamics. Because for me, nothing is worse than having, you know, this awesome arrangement written by whoever that took their time to write piano, forte, crescendo, you know, and it's not being, utilized. You know, there's nothing worse than that. You know, like, it's the difference between, you know, if you talk to someone and they talk like this and it just, you know, they understand everything they say, but it's really boring and monotone. You know, we all know people like that. But if you can give some ways to make it sound great, and then, you know, like, that's, it's, there's a reason why all that, those things are in the dynamics and everything. I mean, it's really important. So that's usually, that's most of the rehearsal time, is that I'm trying to just kind of nail that into their minds, you know, that's so important.
Yeah, whenever you're playing, I think that, yeah, the dynamic component is, like, what makes the music magical. You know, the dynamic swell and the decrescendo, right? Yeah. And you know, and then, like, if you're playing in an ensemble, just to get that sound, that is, it just sounds like, even if you're playing different tones in the harmony, it just sounds together. The attack is soft. Yeah. You know, the decay is soft. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I always like to think, like, one individual note, like the beginning, the middle, and the end, you know?
Yep. Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, and I think it's easy when you get in a group, like a big band is typically about, you know, 16 to 18 people. You kind of forget about it. You think that maybe your individual attack isn't that important. But I remember when I was the first night with Glenn Miller Orchestra, I thought I was nailing everything. I was sight reading everything. I felt so proud of myself. And the lead player leaned over to me and said, "You played this note too long. You played this note too short. You didn't, you know, play vibrato with us on this," you know, like nitpicking. But he was right. I mean, that's how a big band should sound. That's how an ensemble should sound, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's crucially important. So for any of the students, young cats that are tuning in, if you're playing by yourself, the way that you approach dynamics is going to really make the difference between someone who is good or okay and being, you know, leaving the listener or the audience with, you know, just, you know, a special performance, you know, just those little things.
And yeah. I was talking to a student earlier today about that, being more obsessive with listening. And this student is a great listener, and you know he gets solos without writing it down, and you know, transcribes solos just by hearing it. Great ear, but it's still that aspect that I want him to focus more on is the attack of his favorite trumpet players. You know, that attack, the accents, where they put the accents, are they slurring something or are they tonguing something? So you could say, okay, I got every note of his solo note for note. Okay, that's the first step, yeah. But still, like it's almost like trying to imitate someone's voice. You could imitate the words that they're saying, but that doesn't mean you're imitating their voice. I'm more interested in him, in all of us being obsessive about each attack and each swell, like you said, or you know, dynamic. Those things are crucial, and that separates one guy from another, or one woman from another.
Right. If you could go back and tell your 15-year-old self just about music, if you could go back and tell your
15-year-old, I'm about to make a list. I'm going to make another list.
One thing, your 15-year-old self about music, what would you say?
I would tell my 15-year-old self to be more specific in my practice, to have more concentrated practice. I was practicing when I was 15, but I think I wasted a lot of time, right, and wasn't focusing on the things that I should have been only focusing on. So that's what I try to do now, and that's what I try to tell my students, that, you know, Kenny Warner, I was at a masterclass with Kenny Warner, great piano player, and he said when he was a kid, he would focus only on the stuff that he had to work on that he wasn't playing well. Do that in order to be able to watch Welcome Back, Cotter, which was a sitcom in the 70s. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like he had his practice time and he was looking at the clock. He was like, all right, I got to get this done. I got to make sure I do this. Okay, now I can go and watch TV. You know, like that kind of practice, I think, is really, you know, specific. And I think it helps out. It's not just like, all right, I have 5 hours to practice. Let me go through this page, this page, this page. I think we need to be more focused in what we do. Maybe today you don't need to play long tones. So, don't play long tones, you know?
Right. I think that's a really great answer because the way that you practice or the way you learn is different for everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the stuff that we're talking about, there may be somebody that is, what we're trying to do as educators is kind of fast track your learning process. Like, a lot of the mistakes that we made, a lot of the time that we wasted doing stuff that maybe didn't work out as well, you can eliminate that part of your journey and your process. you know, you can almost like fast track your learning, right? Be very specific when you're practicing. Don't just, I mean, of course, it's important to just play for the sake of playing. But when you're practicing and you really want to like implement a new piece of information or implement a new technique, be very specific in doing that in order to do it. You know, it's don't.
And with the trumpet, I mean, we complain a lot as trumpet players because, you know, it's a instrument that just wears us out if we don't do it correctly. And I remember I would get so tired, especially like undergrad when I was, you know, 18, 19. I would just, you know, I had so much work to do, so many classes to practice for. So I'd just warm up for too long. I'd practice way too long. And then my lips would be shot for the rest of the day. I couldn't play anything, you know. So yeah, going back to that, yeah, I think if we're more specific and, okay, I don't need to do this right now. I can do this tomorrow, maybe. I need to focus on this specific thing. And it is an issue figuring out what exactly you need to focus on. But like you said, you know, that's why we kind of ask people that know more than us to let us know what we need to work on.
Yeah, exactly. And then right, once you get these techniques and you implement them into your bag or to, you know, your methods, it's no matter what level you're on, it's a constant thing. Like, you have to practice.
Yeah.
It's just like maintenance on you. You had to go get oil, change on your car, change the tires, right? It's daily maintenance. Exactly. You know, of keeping those things fresh and readily accessible. Mm-hmm. You know, you can have it, but it may not be all that tangible. You know what I mean? Like, you had to reach for it a little further.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of times we think, all right, I already have that. I can forget about it. Yeah. And work on something really hard. But no, yeah, we have to maintain and then add on. But maintenance is necessary, or else we fall back.
Right. And then like the things that we try to do sometimes that we perceive as like difficult, they're just difficult because they're unfamiliar.
Yeah.
Do it 50 times and then it may not seem, you know, as difficult.
Exactly.
You know, it's a process that is consistent no matter what skill, what device, what figure, you know, maybe it's a really, it's a passage that has a lot of technical things in it. It's only difficult initially. Do it, you know, slow it down to an exaggerated degree. Do it a bunch of times. It'll become much more familiar and in turn less difficult, you know.
Exactly. I mean, I always think that, you know, we weren't born to play musical instruments.
Right.
You know, our bodies don't know how to do it instinctively, so we have to train them. And fortunately, we can be trained. You know, we always talk about muscle memory. I think that's a big thing, you know, just over and over. Like you said, you do it 50 times, you'll have a better shot at playing it well than if you just try it a couple times.
Right. And I'm like, admittedly, a slow learner. Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes it takes me a while to really grasp. I mean, to fully get it. Like, I have a piece or a piece of music that I have to perform for something, and I may be able to get through it, you know, but to really understand what's happening, it just takes me a while sometimes.
Yeah.
And but you know, that's it's good to understand that and to realize that, okay, you just need to slow down and take your time and allow yourself, you know, the opportunity to absorb the information, right? Learning, recognizing how you learn is important to, you know, learning or speeding up your learning process, rather.
Yeah, and I think the more we do it, the easier it gets. You know, we just have to go through it. It'll be arduous for a while, but, you know, I think that the more we do it, the easier. Like transcribing, you know, I found that when I started transcribing, it would take me forever to figure something out. And the more I do it, the easier it gets. You know, the things I start to realize, I've heard that before. Okay, I think it's this. You know, like, it's the same with, you know, just like slow and steady practice. I think the more we do it, the easier it'll get in the future.
Right. Yeah, I can't stress the importance of just really, really slowing down and allowing yourself to, you know, to absorb information properly, right? Because you can't instill bad habits if you force things that are just not there. You know, exactly. You can practice bad habits. You can, like, actually build in or bake in things that are not good for your development. Yeah.
And that's what was, like I was saying before, that's what I was doing when I was 18, 19 years old. You know, I was practicing with these bad habits and it was making it worse, you know. Mm-hmm. So it took a while to kind of get over that and start forming better habits. And the good thing is, it's, I mean, we can see that in life too, but for some reason when we have an instrument, we don't we're so stupid.
Right. You can take this same idea and apply it to any part of life, right?
Anything.
But we refuse.
Or, you know, like, a student, wasn't articulating right. And I said, sing the phrase. And he sang it perfectly.
Yeah.
He sang the accents. I was like, so you can do it. You can naturally do it. It's just when we put the horn to our faces, you know, all of a sudden our mind stops working.
Right. So I know we got to cut pretty soon. Steve, if there's anybody that's jumped in, that has any specific questions, we'd be happy to address any of those.
Yeah. Thank you, Jeremy. So I've got a few here. I'm going to try to throw a few things at you that may seemingly be unrelated, but I think they kind of are. When we started talking today, we were talking about preparation and gig preparation, and a big part of the Young Lions audience, you know, these are students. They're students in high school, or they may have just recently graduated. And so I wanted to kind of go back to that. Here's a question, I guess, that touches on inspiration and your enthusiasm and passion for the work as a professional musician. So in between the things that I would assume are obvious inspirations, like when you have your own project and you've got your own concert coming up, or you're going out of town to play a private event, or you have private events, all of those things are exciting in their own right. But in between there's a lot of work that could take the form of a residency somewhere, or maybe a regular gig somewhere. And I guess I wanted to speak to that, the work in between those bigger events and those special projects. Because at least from my observations, you know, young students that really want to do this, you know, these are the first types of things that they may go to jam sessions, or they may be lucky enough to get some type of regular work, right?
Right.
So what is your outlook about sort of regular gigs in terms of can you be inspired by those? Are they opportunities for you as professional musicians, even though you may not be as excited about them as you are for larger events or projects? Do you still look at these as things that can inspire you? Is there a trap of complacency with them? Is there a way to sort of to look at them and have perspective about what these things are? And I'm talking about the more regular gigs, maybe at the local level that you or James perform in. So I'm kind of dancing around a couple things there, but I was hoping the two of you might be able to comment on those. And then I have a related thought too.
Yeah, absolutely. James, you want to start with that one? Or?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it can be a challenge if it's a constant ongoing gig, a regular gig, to keep being inspired. But for instance, you know, like some, I work a lot with singers, and for instance, jazz singers. And for me, it's always a goal. I don't want to read any changes. That's my goal. I don't want to have to read anything. So every night I'm trying to see if I can play that standard that they sing better in whatever key they call it in. They call it in an uncomfortable key. My challenge that night is to play that better than the last time I played it. Really understand the chord changes. Being able to play the melody, even though maybe I'm not supposed to play the melody, but knowing it, that's one thing. And for instance, you know, if I am the leader on a regular jazz gig, I want to be able to bring something new to the table every time that we play. If we're playing every week, I want to bring a new song or a couple of new songs or a new way of playing that specific song. I think those are they're smaller challenges. It's not like playing a big show or a big event, but there are challenges that we can give ourselves in order to make it interesting for us, for the other musicians, and for the audience.
Right. I can say that at least from my perspective, I just turned 42, and I still get excited every time I take my horn out of the case. Like, I'm still, whether it's a big gig or whether, you know, obviously, you know, if accommodations are made and you show up to the gig and they have lobster and caviar and you're getting paid $1 million, that's going to change the way that you feel versus going into some, you know, smoky dive bar and getting $75 and a sandwich. And, you know, so that will change the way you feel, but I don't think in any way that it changes my preparation or excitement towards it. But, you know, everybody has different proclivities, right? And as a young musician, I think that there is a lot of good in it, but to do like an apprenticeship or to do gigs that are both small and large, that's kind of a litmus test. That's going to let you know how serious you are about this thing. You know, if you can still have the same type of joy and excitement about a $75 gig versus getting paid $1,000 or a couple thousand dollars, you know, or if you maybe get a little bit more shine or notoriety, like, you, it's sort of a litmus test. Like, I do it because I love to still play the saxophone. Like, I love to play the instrument and to, you know, interact with other musicians just for the sake of doing that. To me, that's still really fun, and being able to like perform for people and having them smile and dance and cheer, and, you know, the whole fellowship of it is really important. So if you can grasp that or understand, get a hold of that as a young musician, hey, hang on to it, because there will be times where it's not always ideal. Something's going on in your family, you know, you stubbed your toe, the dog died, it's raining, or some other disappointment outside of music will happen. And so you kind of have to use that instead of, like, you know, looking at it as like, oh, I have this thing going on in my life and I'm not playing a gig that really means all that much to me. Like, the music should be a part of, or your life should be a part of the music. You should use it. If you're really, like, if you're a young aspiring musician and you want to take music further, like, it will be a part of your life. So now, like, use these things that occur, you know, as inspiration. Have that be the inspiration, you know, and just the simple joy of playing, I think.
No, that's those both great, great feedback and responses. And, you know, listening to you both, it's sort of like, I think of every one of these experiences really is an opportunity for you as a musician, but also for the people that are there, whether there's 1,000 people there or 5 people in the room, you never know. And, you know, and so it's got to be hard sometimes, particularly as artists are starting out, if there's not a big audience in the room. But it's almost like, you know, that's got to be challenging to prepare yourself so that those 5 people that are there are going to walk away with maybe something memorable for you or from you. And you never know what it's going to lead to.
And that's completely right. Going back to Louis Armstrong, I've heard stories about him, about his preparation backstage before the concert. It didn't matter if there were 5 people or 5,000. He would still, you know, we always see him smiling and joking around and this and that, but There are some pictures of him backstage, and he's just, you know, like focusing. He's serious. He's focusing. And some people say, you know, they asked him, why you being so serious? It's just a couple of people out there. It's a light audience. He said, I don't, maybe one person traveled, you know, from Canada to see me here, or, you know, like every night was important to him. I think that's, you know, awesome for us to keep in mind.
Yeah, no, I think that's really good advice, particularly to younger artists. And I guess my related kind of follow-up thoughts about this are for young artists that are lucky enough to capture a regular opportunity to perform at a venue, a restaurant or a bar. What advice or guidance tips might you share about that relationship with that venue? Is there a strategy to becoming part of a music scene at a venue? Do you approach it by, do you go have dinner? And go there and do you think about how can my music add to the experience of this environment? You know, what can you share to a young person trying to, you know, develop these relationships with venues or get more regular work?
Go ahead, James.
No, I mean, having dinner, I mean, I don't know if it's a good idea, but I don't know if that's necessary. But yeah, like if you're going to the place to check it out, yeah, you want to sit down and kind of suss it out. Talk to the people, be courteous, be generous, be, you know, have a business card. I'm still obsessed with business cards. You know, they're so cheap. Leave that business card, because if you don't and you leave, they're going to think, what was that guy's name? Oh, the one guy that said he played the set, you know, leave them something that they can, yeah, they'll throw it on the shelf, but then they can still look at it whenever they, you know, and go, yeah, start a rapport with these people. We're all, honestly, the more I play in clubs and bars and restaurants, the more I realize that we're all in the same game. And we're more alike than not. They want people to come and purchase their goods. We want to play for people, those same people. So it's a symbiotic relationship. So we need to establish some kind of relationship. Even if it's just further down the line, just planting a seed and saying, you know what, it would be cool down the line if, you know, if I could bring a trio here, I think it would be really good for this place. Obviously having musical samples, whether it's on YouTube or if you can just send them a link or anything, just to kind of give them a idea of what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. Just like in any business, right? You want to be professional. You want to be courteous. You know, you want to be nice. And you want to, like, kind of like you said, you have to know what it is you have to offer them, you know. And right, I mean, today's game, you kind of have to be a little bit more ambitious than in times past, just because of the way that the business is. With social media and with so many digital formats that are out there, you know, people have short attention spans, you know, things move fast, right? So you do have to be a little bit more aggressive and persistent, but just when you do it in a genuine fashion. Know that you're providing them with something. They're compensating you for what you're giving them. It's an honest agreement. It's a mutually beneficial agreement, right? Like you said, we're in the same game. They want people to come to buy stuff. You want people to come and listen. You want to, you know, every part of it feeds the other one if it's done properly, right? Yeah. The people.
And also, I think in that, you know, asking what they want also is a good way. For instance, yeah. Someone called me, a club owner called me and said, I'm having this private party, but I just want background music. I mean, we always make fun of that, you know, like we don't want to be background music all the time, but he came out and he said, this is what I want. Honestly, I just want background music. And I said, okay, I can do that for you. And that's it, you know, like ask them what they want specifically also. Maybe they want smooth jazz and you want to play bebop. That's not going to work out unless you can play smooth jazz. So be specific, you know, figure out what, how you guys can come to an arrangement, an agreement, and make it the best experience possible for everyone.
No. Yeah, it's funny you say that because I've showed up because I play solo gigs all the time, which is like straight wallpaper music, right? But I've showed up and the client has had a different idea of, we've had a different expectation set, right? They wanted a show, like they wanted a concert. I thought I was just going to be like over on the side. They want me to like walk around the audience and high step.
High five. You know,
seriously, can you like walk around and, you know, like just get into it? I'm like, what? Can I do that from here?
Exactly. So, I mean, that's important whether you're starting off, you know, playing, you know, the first time at a place or if it's an ongoing thing. I think that, you know, transparency is super important. You know, like tell me exactly what you want. Because this is what I'm focused on. This is kind of what my specialty is. Tell me, like last night I had a group of Greek, it was a Greek family. They came in to the restaurant and they wanted Greek music. And if I had known that they were coming in, I would have tried to figure out some Greek music, but unfortunately I didn't know any, you know, so. But, you know, in that case, I told them, I'm sorry, I don't know any Greek music. I can, you know, show you something else. But I think that we have to be the same way with club owners and bar owners and managers. You know, we kind of have to meet each other halfway.
And then also, depending on the situation, you might want to try to consider some type of written agreement. You know, depending on how the situation is laid out, like if it's something, if somebody you feel, and this you have to use your own discretion, if it's somebody you feel comfortable with and the net loss of something going completely backwards or, you know, back crazy, if it's not that big a deal, if we're only talking about $100, $200 over the span of 3-4 months, maybe not a contract. But if you potentially could be held liable for, you know, you've made promises to other people or that, you know, you just want to show that you have that level of professionalism and you don't think that they'll object to it, absolutely get a written agreement.
Yeah. And the written agreement is very simple. I mean, it could be very basic, just saying, your name, agree to play, blah, 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 sign it, the date, all that. It doesn't have to be a 5-page thing. It could just be a really small agreement.
Right.
No, and this is some great feedback today. And we're approaching about the hour mark.
Yeah.
I wanted to, as we kind of wind down here, I wanted to just share with you both some statistics about these Young Lions Jazz Master virtual sessions. I think you'll get a kick out of this. So I was just looking at some notes. Since we started this, right, really at the beginning of the pandemic in 2020, we're approaching the 200th session that we've
had.
We have had close to 1,000 live participants in the sessions, and we have supported nearly 50 different musicians, local and not so local, with this particular initiative alone. What's more difficult to measure is how many views and listens that we have had for once the videos get recorded, which is a lot. I'm looking just on the podcast element of this. It's been listened to in 66 different countries with over 6,000 plays. Just on the podcast side of things, not necessarily all the stuff that's on YouTube. Wow. The top three or four countries, of course, the United States, but then Germany, Israel, and Canada and Japan are the next most popular listening to these things.
Wow. So, very cool.
It's kind of unbelievable, really, to think about, you know,
it is.
Just the idea that starts and where it goes. But I just wanted you both to know that, you know, we appreciate you guys being part of this, and it's really becoming something, I think, bigger than any of us thought it would when we started doing this.
Well, we appreciate you and all of you that work for Clearwater Jazz. I mean, it's such a great thing, that offshoot that you've done, that's just proven, obviously, from the statistics, it's proven to be so beneficial. We appreciate you guys.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks, guys. So, Jeremy, any closing remarks or thoughts as we wind down and look forward to the next time we're together?
Yeah, practice hard and have some fun. Don't take things too seriously and keep swinging.
All right. Well, James, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners or viewers as we part?
You know, just hearing Jeremy and I are really good friends, and just hearing him talk about all this stuff reminds me that if there are any young saxophone players or musicians, any other musicians that need some further instruction, please seek out local greats like Jeremy. go listen to him play, go listen to him talk, get a lesson from him. It'll make things a lot easier, I swear.
No, for sure. And for our listeners and viewers out there, if you want to see a specific topic covered on these sessions, or if you'd like to connect with any of the participating musicians, please email us at info@clearwaterjazz.com, and we'll do our best to facilitate that. So, guys, on behalf of the Clearwater Jazz Holiday Foundation, thank you again, and we look forward to hanging with you soon.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank you for listening to Clearwater Jazz Holidays Young Lions Jazz Master Virtual Sessions. Thank you to our friends at Marine Max Clearwater for helping to present this podcast series. To learn more about the Clearwater Jazz Holiday Annual Festival tradition, other special events throughout the year, and our year-round education and outreach, please visit clearwaterjazz.com.